if you are running from your sexuality, you're not going to be healthy. If you are constantly in a battle with it, that's going to undermine your peace of mind. Coming to terms with it is often just trying to let it teach you a bit, taking a moment to look at it, to actually relate to it as a sacred part of being human, like a driver of our desire for communion and connection with each other. You know, part of living in the richness of life is living in the sensuality of it.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Hey everybody, Hunter Otis here. Welcome to the Porn-Free Revolution, where we're here to help guys quit porn and never fear their urges again. I am extremely excited today. We have one of our personal heroes, Nicole and I, our personal heroes, Jennifer Finlayson Fife, with us today. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us. Like, it really, really means a lot.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
And here's why she's one of our heroes, okay? So not only has she helped how we approach our own sexuality, my wife and I, individually and together in our relationship, but in our private therapy practice as well, it's really revolutionized the way that we approach sexuality with our clients across the board. And it has been, I'm a little emotional about it. Like, it's been life-changing for us and for many of the people that we serve. So seriously, thank you so much.
Well, it's my honor, really.
Wasn't expecting to get all emotional right away at the beginning, but I hope that this can just impress upon you, those that are listening. If you know Jennifer already, awesome. We're so happy to have you listening in. If you don't, what made the huge difference for me, so I have struggled personally with pornography for many, many years, and which is why we do what we do in helping men and couples. And for me, a big issue was it was all about quitting porn, you know, being honest, learning how to have empathy for my wife, but there was still this massive divorcement from my own sexuality. It was all about control and trying to just manage it all the time. And in learning from Jennifer, it's like there's so much more to the picture. And I've learned that our sexual energy is truly our creative power. And when we can integrate it healthfully, it just infuses every area of your life with power. And my life in the last few years. So we went to the Art of Loving retreat, I think two Novembers ago in Utah. I went to that one. Then we also did the couples retreat, Nicole and I together. And of course, we bought all the courses and everything. But there were monumental shifts that happened for me in that retreat where my eyes were opened. And since then, it's just been a wild ride, like in the best way possible.
Wow, so, that's great.
Thank you so much. So I highly recommend like putting a plug in here right away. If you're a man and you want a healthier relationship with your sexuality, go to finlayson-fife.com. I'll put a link below, of course, and we'll talk more about this towards the end, but feel free to check out her retreats and her courses because they are well worth it. Let's jump right in, huh?
Yeah, let's do it.
So a big problem that I have had to overcome and that the men that I work with are facing is just that so many of us men are taught that our sexuality and desire itself is dangerous or shameful or scary or bad. Right.
Yes.
And I guess to kick us off, it's like, how can a man begin to see his sexuality as good, like even sacred? Like, that's where I've come to find it, that it's actually sacred and not just something to fear or hide. Like, where does he even begin to start?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if you are a religious person, and even if you're not, I mean, that we were born as sexual beings. Like, out of the gate, that is just true. Yet a lot of us have learned, and oftentimes in adolescence and in religious communities, there's kind of the fear of sexuality. And so when a person's sexuality comes on board in a more recognizable way in adolescence, oftentimes adolescents and boys in particular are receiving messages like, this is a threatening part of who you are. It's a part that's going to threaten your spirituality and your goodness. Coupled with that, in the larger culture, some of the kind of Me Too messaging and sexual perpetration, all of which is serious and
right.
important that we deal with. But it can also give the message, especially to more sensitive souls, I mean, in the best sense, that men can fear and feel that kind of their sexuality is both dangerous to their own souls, but also an intrusion, an unwelcome reality to a woman or to a partner. And so there can be an understandable anxiety. You know, even if you take cultural messaging away, I think there is also just some anxiety about the question of how acceptable am I? Am I really worthy of love? What right. about this part of myself? It can be challenging, even in the best of circumstances, to really be at peace with our sexuality because it's a strange part of the human experience. It's outside of polite society, you know? And so we can really be unclear about, would someone really accept me, really love me? Would they find my sexuality to be a good thing or just something they tolerate? Mm-hmm. So I think that we have our anxieties just out of the gate about who we are, especially in adolescence. I think that captures the experience of adolescence. And then often people are receiving messages in the larger culture, in their religious culture, in their family culture, that this is a bad or dangerous part of you, or only if you constrain it almost unto death could it possibly be a good thing.
Right.
And so, meaning, you know, maybe to have children, you know, maybe, but not like actually as part of our spirituality. Very right. few of us think of it as actually like a gift and yeah. as actually like a really good part of being a human being. And so I think just to this question is that I think we have to go back to the fact that God made me a sexual being and not just to reproduce. And in LDS theology, I am LDS, and you know, there's a scriptural idea that we might have joy, that we exist for the purpose of experiencing joy.
Right.
But a lot of us live our religion and even our sexuality like joy is suspect, like happiness is a, you know, maybe for the indulgent, but not for the long suffering, pleasure denying faithful.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, understandably in a lot of ways, because sexuality can be dangerous. You can see why societies and religious cultures want to constrain sexuality because you can do harm with it. You really can. And you can have children out of wedlock and you can create trouble with sexuality. So it's not strange that we want to control it, but often the ways that we try to control it then actually interfere with creating breaks. We need breaks. We need to be able to regulate ourselves around our sexual impulses. But often in our attempt to teach that or to learn it, we are so constraining, so shame-based that we get either compulsive about it or we shut it down entirely. Or even if we are sexual, we can't sort of be in our own experience. So I think we have to start with, I keep giving the context, but coming back to this of like, God made me sexual, you know, or just I am a human being who was born sexual. Sex isn't inherently good or bad, but how I relate to it, what I do with it will determine its virtue in my life.
Yes.
And so I am a sexual being. I have this language. I have this way of relating to myself and others. I need to think about how I want to engage this part of being human. And what's going to accrue to my well-being and the well-being of my relationships?
Yeah, I personally, I mean, it was just because my sexuality was so caught up in a compulsive behavior.
Yeah.
That I kind of like, I don't know, I just lumped it all in together, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And then I struggle with this. And then because then I was using it as a coping mechanism, there's this neediness, right?
Yes.
In my relationship with my wife.
Yes.
And then so I would get rejected, but then I would just end up lumping the shame from
right.
this behavior over here, what I was doing here, in, into, you know, shaming the fact that I had sexual desire for my wife because I just couldn't
yes.
separate the two.
Right. And it just like becomes more and more of a knot because then like the pornography actually becomes easier because, you know, I'm imagining anyway that at least
yep.
I can feel freer there. I don't have to deal with the rejection, but then I feel terrible about me and
yep.
And it's very easy to keep it going.
Right. And we'll talk probably more about this, but then that intimacy being damaged because then I feel like I have to hide this part of myself because I'm so ashamed.
Yes, right? Exactly.
And so then it's hard to even show up sexually with your spouse because for me, it was like, well, what if she knew the truth about me, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's shame, just like it permeates everything. So, and you often talk about how our relationship with our sexuality like mirrors or reflects our relationship with ourselves. So what does it look like when a man has a fractured sexual self? Like, what does that mean? And then how does porn cause that, or is it merely just a symptom of it?
Probably to that last question is probably both, that it can drive you to porn and then it can also reinforce that feeling. Like, I really believe that our sexuality is tied to our most core sense of who we are. That's why sexual trauma is so disruptive, because it's disrupting the core of who we are. It's a much different thing to have somebody come and, you know, steal your credit cards than to violate you sexually, because it's just so fundamental. And so, and yet it's a strange part of ourselves. So it like really pushes the question of like, am I lovable all the way through? Am I acceptable? And when we have been given those messages, and or we stumble into porn, which is very typical now. It used to be you had to go out and actually go find a magazine, be willing to buy it and so on. But now it's just the norm.
It like you have a hypodermic needle in your pocket all the time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just kind of always there. And so when we've received a lot of fear messages around that and pathologizing, because a lot of the people I work with just like grew up believing that this, my draw to this is confirmation that I am spiritually defective. So like everybody thinks I'm a great guy at church or in my community and I'm a good student or whatever. I'm getting all this credit sort of outwardly, but I have this deep, dark secret about myself and my sexuality. And so no matter how much validation you get, you always have this sense that there's something really quite ugly about you and that something that nobody could accept. Even though looking at porn or masturbation is pretty statistically normal. Now, that's different than me saying that it's the most healthy way to address the reality of your sexuality, but it doesn't mean you're defective or that you're strange, but a lot of people go around with that feeling that I'm strange.
Yeah. Like, and I tell my guys, I'm like, you are literally like the least alone part of the population, like on the planet.
Exactly. You are in good company. I mean, whether or not, you know, the company you want is another question for you, but like you are not strange.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I sometimes tell stories of like, even, you know, as a young girl, I used to, you know, I scaled my father's bookshelf to get the book that said The Naked Communist on it, which is like a political philosophy book. There were no pictures of naked communists inside, to my say, but, you know.
I mean, read that book. It's a good book.
It's a good book, exactly. You know, so there's just like, I guess I'm just normalizing like the curiosity, the draw to the sexual and the erotic is 100%, not just normal, but healthy. Right. It's like part of the erotic draw within us. We are in pursuit of mystery. We want to reach beyond ourselves. We want to commune with another person. We want to commune with the world. And so porn is just kind of hijacking that human tendency. And so it makes perfect sense that an adolescent's drawn to it. Right. So when we shame it, though, we're giving the wrong message and we're driving more compulsivity and secrecy.
Right.
So remind me of your question, because I feel like I'm giving so much context. I never
asked. This is fantastic. It's like, what does it look like when a man has a fractured sexual self?
Yeah. So then you just sort of live in these dual worlds, and it becomes, you know, if you want to have sexual intimacy, intimacy is the willingness and the ability to know and be known. Sexual intimacy is to be able to do that through your sexuality, to like reveal your erotic self, to know another's sexual self, to be able to love with it. Well, if you think this is just a horrible part of yourself, you're not going to be capable of sexual intimacy, because you don't really want them to know it. You just want them to know the good parts, the shiny parts, or you're looking to them to validate your sexuality, make it okay. And again, that's very normal. You know, we want sexual acceptance. There's nothing strange about that. But if we don't have peace within ourselves and we're hoping someone can give it to us, we're going to get stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because like I tell my guys all the time too, that basically your external behaviors are always going to realign over time with what you've fundamentally believed to be true about yourself.
Yes.
So like if they believe they're a worthless sack of garbage, like I'm like, well, how do you think you're going to behave over time? Right. You might white knuckle your way through for a while, but eventually you're going to kind of succumb to this identity.
Idea, my default truth.
Right. Right. Yes. And so if you really fundamentally believe that your sexuality is bad, it's going to just continue. You're going to come in and out of this state of it just wreaking havoc in your life because there's this dysfunction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you know, one of the ways that people treat eating disorders, which is, I'm not making these equivalent challenges necessarily, but they're also about integrating sensuality and pleasure and trying to make sense of our draw to something that if we were to only indulge the draw to junk food or sweets, we would have a hard time forging a life that brings us joy because we wouldn't be healthy, right? But if you shame it, like the fact that you want sweets or it just makes you terrible, well, you tend to drive people either into suppression like anorexia or into compulsivity around food. And so you just kind of keep living in this dual idea. And then it keeps reinforcing the idea, I'm a failure. I'm out of control. This has control over me.
Yep.
And while when we're compulsive about a behavior, it certainly does feel like it has control over us and there is a truth in it, but it's often because we're not yet dealing with, we're not getting honest enough and curious enough about who we are, what we're trying to solve through the compulsive behavior, what understandable reason it is that we aren't at peace yet with who we are and our sexuality, why this has been a solution that has a sense in it. Because sometimes we're so afraid of those questions because we're just afraid it's going to reinforce our fearful idea that I'm just worthless and unlovable. We're so afraid that understanding ourselves will reinforce that conclusion. But in my experience of working with people, it actually frees people up to have more compassion towards themselves, to better understand why that became a solution. And then it also drove more shame. And the more they can kind of separate from that, understand it, the more agency they have and the more ability they have to really choose, like, what are the consequences that I want to live in? What's the life I want to create? Who's the person I want to be? Because the more we can align with the highest part of ourselves, our choices with what we respect in ourselves, the more we can actually accept ourselves in an honest way and let someone in on who we are, not because we're without flaw, but we trust ourselves more. We trust our own earnestness more. We can accept our humanity more. And so we're more willing to let somebody in on that.
Yeah, I think for me, a big part of this, and it just kind of segues into the next question, which is basically, you know, so many men that struggle with pornography or compulsive sexually acting out in any way, you know, there's this toxic shame, right? We're already hitting this really, really hard. And we have this massive wall built up, right? And the shame, it's just so hard to penetrate through that. And so the next question is basically like, how can men start to break that down? And but I just, what came to mind was a personal example for me was just having to grieve. Mm-hmm. Like I can remember, sorry, you're going to find this out about me. I'm a very emotional guy. Mm. And I remember there being multiple nights with my wife where there's just this wall of not being able to let her in. Mm. And it's because of this wall of shame and all the past experiences or traumas or what have you. But when I was able to finally just like cry and let that out, like let her see that pain, that grief, it's like that wall started just coming down. But what would you say like around that? Like, are there any other ways?
Faith right there. That was an act of courage to let her into your mind and even you into your mind and heart.
Yeah, that's fascinating you say that, like even letting myself go there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I think, you know, it was an act of faith in her, but also in yourself, that maybe there was room to just know your own pain, your own grief about a place you'd struggled, to let her see your vulnerability and your humanity and to let yourself know it more. I mean, I think a lot of times, some of the people that are most likely to go to porn as a kind of strategy in their lives have the most demand on themselves to present an ideal to the world. They are often
That was me.
They're often the hero children in their family. What I mean by that is the one that the mother or the father thought was the most able. And they feel like this need almost to kind of be the ideal for the sake of the family, for the praise that they get. But then the more that they succeed at that or feel like it's a solution for their own sense of worth or for others, the more they can't actually talk about or integrate the part of themselves that they're not sure is acceptable.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to live in this bifurcated reality. And then there's more and more of a wall, because if I let this in, people would be devastated and amazed. They wouldn't believe that I, the good guy at church, actually, you know, I'm looking at porn 5 days of the week or whatever. And so then it gets even thicker and people feel even more need to look like the ideal, you know, to kind of like manage something. So it can be really isolating and lonely and terrifying to let that wall come down, because I'm going to destroy all the validation I have. It's going to come in and get me all the invalidation of who I am.
Yep.
But that's actually the gateway into freedom and integration and deeper agency. And it's an act of faith. I've just finished a book and I faith is sort of a core throughout it, which is like to love and be loved. Intimacy is a kind of faith. It's like trusting to not judge my humanity by my kind of young mind, my immature mind, the mind that sees people as either good or bad, but to trust in love and compassion and that we are worthy just because we are human beings and children of God, and to actually trust in that even when we're so afraid it isn't true. And so it takes our willingness to surrender our ego and our control and managing how people see us. That's the gateway into deeper intimacy with ourselves, with God, and with another person.
Yeah, this is, I mean, you described me literally to a T, basically. And it's interesting. So that's more than just even shame. There's so many messages kind of all across the board. So many, I guess, frameworks we're trying to uphold.
Yes.
And the ego is just so caught up in that, that it feels like death if you were to let it go.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. And it does at times.
Right. Or, it's like, I mean, this is the only self I know, the self that can do all the things that people respect. They say I'm such a great guy. How can I if I threaten that, or if I let my wife really see who I am, what do I have? And so we keep thinking, I'm just going to deal with it over here privately on my own. I'm going to get rid of it soon. And yet it just keeps both functioning in this bifurcated way.
And yeah. So we're trying to find like it's that solid sense of self, like in and of yourself, right?
That's
versus the external. Like I saw a YouTuber and he's a really young guy. He's probably like 20 years old. He has a couple million followers. And because he started early, like at age 14 or 16 or something like that. And he's talked actually a lot about pornography and things like that. But he just posted, I think yesterday, saying that he's not going to be doing any YouTube videos for a very long time, maybe not come back ever. And it's because he's like, I don't know who I am. I don't know if the person that you're seeing is me or if it's what the algorithm wants from me.
Yeah,
because he's so optimized for views
and on him and listening to him and all that. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was fascinating to see. Is he's now, all right, it's time for me to go and find who I really am.
Yeah, good for him.
And that's kind of what we're plugged into in our families, what you're describing. Like we're plugged into an algorithm of what other people have, the messages we're being told and how we need to behave to belong to the family unit, to society, to our culture, to the church.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's a normal, again, I write about this a lot in the book too. It's normal to start that way. We have to borrow a frame of what it is to be successful. We borrow kind of an understanding of what it is to be good. But to really grow in our capacity for intimacy, we have to create a more honest self, a self that can also fail, a self that is human. And that's the pathway into our deeper integration. But it's terrifying because it's like, well, I know how to be this person. I don't want to be that other kind of person. Or, and even if you tend to go one down, you know, like I'm just the scum of the earth, right? I'm not worth anything. Even that's a very rigid self that you know in a way how to be, as miserable as it might feel to be there. You know how to do one down. Like you were saying about some of your clients, if you just think that's who you are, you're going to keep inviting that reality out of the universe and then limiting who you actually are capable of being, actually who your soul is yearning to be. And so we have to like shatter some of our limited views by breaking them in a sense through our deeper honesty and our deeper courage to find a more solid way of being true to our souls.
This like leads perfectly really into the next question, which is around integrating our sexuality. Like, what does that actually mean? What does it even mean? And for someone that struggles with porn, like what's the difference between just trying to control or manage your urges and actually, you know, integrating your sexuality? But what I'm hearing already, and I'll let you run away with this one, but is that our sexuality is part of us. It is part of yourself. And so if you're divorcing any part of yourself, like it's going to kind of go along with it.
Yeah, you can't do it. I mean, it just as you're saying, it doesn't work. And so the more we try to press down on something, the more it just kind of runs us from underground. And so because it's a part of who we are, if we're always running from it, we're always a house divided. The suppressed parts of ourselves don't go away. They just run us. And we don't have as much conscious control of them.
Right.
And so, again, to know and be known is a core part of Christianity. It's a core aspect of the theology. It's a theology of intimacy. Well, intimacy, we all think we maybe like it, but intimacy is freaking scary, okay? Because intimacy is, I'm actually just a flawed human being who has a ton of insecurities and, you know, maybe I know how to do one thing well, but like I have all these other areas I don't feel competent or able and I'm terribly human and I do stupid things and, you know, okay, so who wants anybody in on that? Not very, you know, anybody on Instagram, that's not what they want. They don't want anybody in on that.
Right, they want
We're offering
the highlight
our curated, you know, visions of our lives, you know, and feeling bad at looking at other people's curated portrayals of their life. And yet that's not true for any of us. We're just fallible human beings that get a very precious small amount of time on this planet, which we're lucky to have at all. And we're trying to figure out how to love in an imperfect body, an imperfect reality, and to develop enough compassion for being a human being and having it both for ourselves and another person. That's quite the project. It's an amazing project. The more courage we have, the richer our lives are. But sexuality is just one part of that. And if I'm just running from it, I'm never going to be able to understand it enough, to understand my own soul enough to figure out how to actually love and be loved through it. So I need to stop running from it. I need to accept it as a given. I'm not going to get rid of it. And so what can I understand about being a sexual being? And that's not necessarily linked to what your choices are. I think sometimes in our kind of post-sexual revolution society, we kind of have this idea that if you're not being sexual, you're not healthy. And I don't have a simple-minded idea about that at all. I don't think that's fair or true.
Yeah.
But what I would say is if you are running from your sexuality, you're not going to be healthy. If you are constantly in a battle with it, that's going to undermine your peace of mind. Coming to terms with it is often just trying to let it teach you a bit, taking a moment to look at it, to actually relate to it as a sacred part of being human, like a driver of our desire for communion and connection with each other. And you know, part of living in the richness of life is living in the sensuality of it. Now, this kind of stuff scares some people that listen to me. Like, I don't mean an indulgent reality, because if you're indulgent, you'll run your life into the ground. What I mean is if you're reckless or you're living for the sake of pleasure only. But if we deny pleasure, if we just say like pleasure is always bad, we never can have joy. And we can't feel the beauty and richness of life, of the miraculousness of being alive at all, of the miraculousness of our partner, of the fact that they love us, you know, of their presence right here and now in our lives, in our bed. Like, it's to kind of wake up to the beauty of that pleasure of being alive and feeling and knowing. And the more we can accept that, like, the more we can make good choices. You know, one of the things that I do sometimes is that I take couples and go to Europe and do a 10-day retreat. And so I'm teaching a few hours a day, and then they're out experiencing. And one of the favorite places is Italy. And the Italians are Epicureans. Like, they understand the spiritual value of pleasure, and they aren't indulgent at all. Like, Americans are way more indulgent. We supersize everything, and we're like, you know, like, saying no to anything is somehow repressive. And yet I think, like, the Italians, they know how everything's, their fashion is beautiful, well curated, well made, but you don't have that much of it. You know, you sit down to a meal, you don't overeat, but you enjoy every single course, and it's presented beautifully. It tastes amazing. They know how to live in the sensual world in a way that accrues to the well-being of your soul. And we're not as good at that in our sort of puritanical West, you know, the American kind of roots of our culture.
Yep.
We often struggle to integrate it, but I think it means we live more in this indulgent versus suppressive reality.
Right.
And I think it's not good for us.
Yeah, there's one individual that we follow, and she talks about just, she's all about having gourmet sex, right?
Yeah.
None of this cheap surface level, and she's very against pornography as well, but very, very connected to her sensuality and sexuality. And we've learned a ton from this individual. But what I've found is, when you're denying the pleasure, like you said, this thing that you're suppressing becomes the shadow government that's running your life. It feels like it's starving. It feels like it's just controlling you. And so, but when I've noticed that when it's integrated or accepted as part of myself, and I also accept that intimacy with my wife is required, like, knowing and being known is required to fully surrender to each other.
Yeah.
Well, then we can have that gourmet sex. We can have that incredible, deep, meaningful connection. And all the other stuff goes away. Like, the desire for the other stuff goes away because it's so empty and shallow in comparison. Yeah. You're just like, I don't even want that. That was it's trash in comparison. Yeah, it's the supersized McDonald's meal versus you know, home cooked, like, homegrown food, right?
Yeah,
super 100%. Powerful. Mm-hmm. So then what do you see? So when men are able to successfully, because this is like, the vision is so important, you guys, like, being able to see, like, what you want. And so that you can surrender to it is so important. So when you are able to surrender and integrate the sexuality, what would you say, Jennifer, like, what does it look like when a man has successfully done that? Like, what outcomes do they experience in their life? Obviously with their intimate relationship with their partner, but elsewhere, what do you see?
Well, I would say when I've worked with people who've gotten more deeply honest with themselves, they're more aware of their sexual behavior. They're more accepting of their sexuality and their sexual nature. They're more accepting of themselves. First of all, the compulsivity thing goes away. I mean, it's kind of amazing how effective that is to help people just get more in the driver's seat of their lives through just understanding, so they don't feel so blind to themselves and therefore feel powerless. So getting clearer about who they are, being more honest with themselves, with their partner, they just start to feel more peace and less need to kind of run away from their lives. They're not using pleasure as an escape because they don't need to so much. They're more at ease in their own skin. But often what also happens is the quality of the marriage connection goes up because they feel more self-respect. Their spouse respects them more. They feel more able to choose to love through their sexuality. They feel more able to even understand what that might mean, what that might feel like. And so then their sexuality starts to feel more like a gift, actually, because this is this powerful way that I feel a sense of connection and acceptance and ease that I've never felt before. And you know, when sex is really, really good, we often talk about it like as if there's just explosive fire. And no, I have nothing against any of those things, like mind-blowing sex, wonderful. Like, I hope everybody in the world can have it with you know, a beloved spouse. So I also think that the high-meaning sex, so often what it is we really accept each other. We really enjoy each other. We're glad to have one another here. That's the core meaning of good sex. And when you're not running from yourself and you're building something honest, start to really have that feeling, like a really deep gratitude. I remember somebody telling me about this. He'd taken the Art of Loving course and had started to just get much more honest with himself, with his spouse. And sex had always been so fraught. But because there was just this deepening honesty, deepening awareness, the gratitude in the marriage was growing. The sense of trust in the marriage was growing. And he wrote about having this experience of sexual intimacy that was like, it wasn't about like the particular behaviors. There was just this sense of like deep gratitude and appreciation, and that they both were tearful in this joyful way about this sense of gratitude and acceptance and love for each other. And, you know, just kind of that he was marveling at the amount of peace and joy that his soul felt that he didn't even know was possible with sex.
Yeah, Jennifer, I love what you were just sharing. And it reminded me of something that you brought up in the course, in the retreat, about cherishing. And you told us that truly cherishing your partner was this like recognition of death, actually, and of loss. And that when you're really, truly like surrendering into this intimacy with your partner, it's just this deep sense of gratitude. So you were mentioning gratitude. It's just the best way of describing it. It's like this person could be gone tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so it's worth me letting down my walls. It's worth surrendering my fear and my shame and all of these different things that I'm struggling with, because they could be gone tomorrow and I might not have the opportunity.
Exactly.
So that was just coming up as you're sharing all of this, like why it's so worth this work and honoring and owning these different parts of ourselves.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's just so well said. I think, you know, that we so easily relate to the world in terms of needing the validation of others, living in the fear of losing it. These are all very understandable things, you know, losing track of how precious it all is. I went to go exercise this morning and I was walking on the sidewalk that I walk over all the time. I'm usually running over it to get there on time, you know.
Right.
And I wasn't in a hurry. And I was just like, looking at the sidewalk squares. It's just a simple thing, but I was actually like seeing these patterns in there that I'd never seen before, even though I'd run over it many times. Noticing just like, it's strange, like there's nothing precious about concrete sidewalks. I don't know, it's just like seeing it, actually appreciating it for a minute, like that here it is and I don't even fully acknowledge it, even though it's a part of my regular experience. And it was just like a small moment. There's a lot more to cherish in life than sidewalks. But I think it's like so much about recognizing we're so fortunate to be here. So fortunate for those of us who are partnered to have someone there by our side. And to live like that, though, takes courage.
Right.
It takes staying awake. It takes not just numbing out, getting on social media, getting on whatever, that just our lives just kind of float by, but instead to stop and pay attention to this precious person who's next to you, because you don't know how many more moments you'll have. And so embrace it, receive it. It's, you know, it's what Dr. Schneider, a sex therapist, says, it's a way of sanctifying a moment. Is to really receive it and to receive the other.
Yeah, my wife, we've just had a ton of family in town and we just talked to each other and just said, you know, while everyone's here, we want to stay connected, because in the past, historically, you know, I was less aware And I would end up talking. I'm very much so a talker, and I would end up talking to family, and then she'd end up, you know, being in the kitchen and doing the dishes.
Yep.
But we've grown a lot. And this time I was just like, this is not going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. In the past, it's been much better, but I was like, no.
Yeah.
I'm going to be fully present with my wife, and we're not going to throw any like jabs at each other because we're kind of irritated with each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, like we are on a team. We are united. Yeah. And, you know, that comes first. And something that she came up with was like, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to kiss more often. But every time we kiss, we need to kiss for 6 seconds. And it's funny because she'd come up and kiss me, and normally she was the one like the quick peck and I'm out here, right? And, but that moment of like, oh, wow, no, I have to keep kissing you here and everybody's around. If we have to like count to 6 seconds, but it's become this really fun, energizing thing that we've been doing. And I'm guessing we're probably going to keep doing it because it's just been
brilliant.
It really slows you down and it makes you really see the other person.
Way, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like, it's a way of like harnessing the erotic actually to wake you up to your life, because the thing that's so powerful about Eros or erotic energy is that it pulls you into a moment, like time stands still. You know, if you're aroused, you lose track of anything outside of you and your spouse. And so moments of communion throughout the day, not only are they good for your sex life because they're a way of bringing that sexual energy to one another, but it's a way of communing, celebrating the other person in the moment, like being aware, you know? And so you're in that energy before one leaves or in the middle of the kitchen. It's really good for the couple. It's also good for all the kids that are aware of it, honestly, because like mom and dad like each other. It's a big deal.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's been really, really fun. And it reminds me, you know, when we are viewing pornography, it's like you get pulled into this bubble.
Yeah.
And like you said, like that time stops where, you know, when you lose track of time, all of a sudden 2 hours goes by.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
how did this happen? Well, imagine if you were, instead of, you know, giving into that and giving your energy and your life force over to that, where you feel so drained afterwards, where something is taking from you, imagine channeling that and creating a bubble that's sacred.
That's
with
right.
your partner instead, and being able to fully share yourself with someone, to have someone witness your life, to choose each other, like all the things that you're wanting that the porn is kind of giving you can actually be yours. But it is, it's having the faith. I love so many things here. Like just the fact that you said it's an act of faith, like intimacy as an act of faith. That is kind of a revolutionary idea in my mind right now, because it truly is. It's terrifying. Mm-hmm. You have to take the leap, but when you do, you may get hurt.
Yeah.
But it's worth the pain. It's worth facing that.
It's worth the pain, because if you follow what's honest in your soul, it always leads you to someplace stronger. It doesn't mean you won't be disappointed. It doesn't mean that it won't in some ways undo your soul to redo it. You know, like when we reach into the uncertainty of our lives, when we dare to let go of something without really knowing what's going to replace it. You know, I was talking to my husband about that today. I'm trying to remember why it even came up, but he had read a quote where someone was saying that so often the things that are hardest to change is when a client is trying to self-heal, that we kind of get attached to something, a process, you know, say alcohol or something. We're trying to like manage something inside of ourselves. And the author was talking about how hard it is to break that particular reality. So porn could be one of the. So my husband had read this article, and we were talking about it, and he was saying it's like you kind of need to give somebody something to replace it with first, you know, like maybe that's how you do it. And I said, I actually think it's not the way it happens. It's tolerating the not knowing what to replace it with. It's tolerating the discomfort. It's being in the disorganization of not running to something you know that gives you momentary comfort, but makes you feel terrible ultimately. And so it's the faith of like, I don't know what to do. I just know what not to do. And that's usually where humans grow, is in that space, because if they can get over the anxiety and the fear, then you start to see clearly enough in that space of what might be the right choice, what might be the place to do. But you also aren't reeling in the feeling of, you know, my son struggled for a period of time with going to video games, and he was quite good at them, and it was a way of coping with his anxiety about school and just the uncertainty of life. And you know, I would sometimes try to focus with him on what were his long-term goals? Like, what did he actually want to get to? And something, you know, he was working with someone, and something he said to me is, what actually helps me is not that idea. It's more just that I will feel better right now if I just don't go do the thing that distracts me from my life. Like, I will... I mean, what he was saying is, yes, I will feel bad at first, but if I want my life quality to even improve in the immediate sense, don't do the thing that makes me feel terrible about myself. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, we talk a lot about, like with my men, we talk about processing urges or urge surfing.
Yes.
As a way of just accepting what is in the moment.
Yeah.
It's not bad that you feel bad. You just feel
right.
Bad. And
exactly.
It's okay. Like being able to own and accept what's happening, embrace discomfort. And as you do that and just wait, even if it's 10
yes.
minutes,
just wait.
It will absolutely change. It will shift. It will move, right? Yeah. And then, you know, adding other practices in there to kind of get that urge flowing and moving throughout your body, or even just circulating your sexual energy. Like, I don't know if you've heard of this before, but this is kind of like a Taoist thing of, like, it's called the microcosmic orbit.
Mm.
Which is very interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but where you're breathing in, and this sexual arousal for men, if it's, say, it's in the groin, it's like you're imagining it going up your back into the top crown of your head and down and just circulating kind of around your heart.
Yeah.
And just this idea of getting it moving, and so that you don't feel so stuck and trapped, or like you have to do something or you're going to die, right? It's like, no, I'm feeling this. It's okay.
Yep.
It's good.
It's kind of like a physical version of integration.
Yeah.
Right. And even really good sex involves a kind of sensual integration, in my opinion. Like, sometimes people that have sex that's too groin focused, it's too immediately kind of resolving it.
Right.
What I do with couples is just teaching them to be in the erotic energy more, even if their spouse isn't, you know, like let themselves just integrate it, feel it, but not have to move into any behavior in the moment, or feel it between them without having to move into sexual behavior.
Right. Like, the goal isn't the goal isn't orgasm, right? It's
exactly
being deeply connected.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love it.
So the more we get comfortable in it, the more we can really let it bless our lives.
Mm-hmm. So, like, here's just a good example. I have a client right now that he just started working with me, and he's really concerned because here he's trying to avoid pornography, and he's very early in his journey, but this comes up a lot. So they're trying to avoid pornography. They're working at self-mastery there and what have you, and the skills that I teach and all that. But then on the other hand, they're essentially kind of scared of their wives for a while. One, because they've caused a lot of damage, dishonesty, right?
Yep.
It's very disruptive. But then they're really afraid of being aroused by their wives.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're afraid of wanting sex with their wives being like a replacement for the pornography, and they're acting out there.
Yep.
And maybe sometimes it is, but how can a man distinguish his sexuality, or wanting to use his sexuality to connect, versus to escape when he's in this process of integration and self-mastery and what have you?
Yeah. Well, one thing is that just the process you're talking about of not rushing into behavior or into climax, you know, is one way of getting out of the, I must go into it, you know, use orgasm or explicit sexual behavior that's just one way of slowing it down. Like, if I can just notice the arousal, be in the arousal, notice the attraction to my wife, and just sort of try to settle myself down in that feeling a little bit, that's just one way of getting out of my limbic, you know, instinctive mind and a little more centered into my own body. so that I'm more able to make decisions there, more able to kind of accept those feelings, see them, understand them, and know that I'm leading with a stronger part of me. You know, if there's an anxiety in it, you can just kind of basically distrust it a little bit, right?
Right.
Because the anxiety is just sort of like, it's kind of driving the decisions rather than your more anchored mind.
Yeah.
So that's one thing, is just taking a minute. And there's nothing, you know, I'm, you know, working with a couple, he's always been the higher desire person. His wife has always had a lot of explicit sexual anxiety, but I gave them the assignment to just lie in bed naked next to each other and just be with one another. Don't do anything. And if you feel arousal, to just enjoy it, but just be there.
Yeah.
Well, it was like way harder for him than he was expecting. Like, he's like, kind of like, either I've got to get rid of the feeling because we're not doing anything,
yeah,
or I need to get her to want to do something, which gives me anxiety because she never likes it or whatever. And so,
right.
And he was like noticing, I'm just like not very good at just being in the feeling, like, and letting it take care of me in a way. We tend to grow up thinking that sexual feelings never take care of you. They're something that caused some panic. Like,
right.
Either get your spouse to want to do it, you know, or get rid of the feeling, rather than it's a great part of human nature. And we can channel it. We can utilize it for creativity, for communion, for connection. Like, it can be such a driver of our souls. But if we're so afraid of it, we have a hard time knowing how to work with it and make decisions from it.
Mm. This is really powerful, because I mean, I remember times, so many times for myself, like getting aroused and my wife not being in that space, especially when it was coming from a place of massive neediness, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's just such a desire killer. But I remember then having the sensations in my body and feeling so angry.
Yes, exactly.
And I would at times take that anger out on her, for sure.
Yeah.
But then other times it wasn't even taking it out on her. It was just this conditioning, I guess maybe you could say, where when this feeling comes up in my body, I have to do something with it.
Exactly.
And that's where the compulsivity towards pornography came in. Yes. Big time, right? But yeah, it's this, when you're owning your sexual self, you're able to accept that feeling in your body.
Yes.
That is okay. That you don't need to run. You don't need to resolve it.
And that is integration. It's like, okay, it's not running you.
Mm.
You can accept the feeling, even grief, loss. I mean, feelings, that the wiser we are, it's not that we don't have difficult feelings. We just don't feel so terrified of them, so run around by them.
Mm.
We're just more able to accommodate those feelings, let them teach us, let them take care of us, let them help us. But then we are able to choose in a way that we think is wise and good for us.
Oh, yeah, this is awesome. Maybe one of my final questions for you is, for the man who's struggling but wants to start opening this door of honesty around his sexuality, and what he's thinking, feeling with his partner, what would maybe be some baby steps or initial steps to kind of start opening that door with their partner, whether their partner's on board with it or not?
I think in some ways you need to just ask yourself, what is the thing I've been afraid to acknowledge honestly to myself and to my spouse that I know needs to be addressed? That I know, if I'm being honest with myself, I need to face and reveal. And that's going to be different for different people. For some, that's secrecy, something that's more about, you know, keeping information that your partner would want to know because it's limiting their ability to make choices for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Other times it's like, you know, sometimes this is true for women too, but the male version of it can be, men are sort of taught to be nice guys, and so I'm going to not deal with my disappointments, my frustrations, you know, my honest view of the impact of a spouse's behavior, because I'll never get sex again if I do, or I need to like basically manage their feelings so they see me as a nice guy. And when someone does that, it creates a dishonest marriage. It keeps the marriage from growing. It's also often the way that nice guys then go to porn, because they feel like I'm the one who's giving so much and I'm the strong one here and therefore I kind of deserve this because she'll never choose me. So it might mean being honest about the marriage, the disappointments, and it will create conflict most likely, but we need not be so afraid of conflict if it's based on what is honest and real and that the marriage needs to deal with.
Well, Jennifer, this has been extremely powerful, and I hope it's been of a benefit to those that are listening. I know I've benefited a ton today personally, and it's so cool to kind of, after, you know, a couple of years here, to be able to kind of, I feel like, bring it full circle in this conversation with you about some of the things that I've learned, that my wife and I have learned, and just how much it's changed our life. And I just want to encourage anyone here with us today to have courage, right? To take that leap of faith and to learn more about yourself, about your sexuality, about who you really are as a whole person, not this, you know, compartmentalized, fractured version of yourself, that you deserve to have a life of wholeness and of joy that Jennifer was talking about. So I love that. Thank you so much. I guess, tell us a little bit more about the book that you're writing. So Jennifer has a book coming out in September, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about that and what we have to look forward to there, because it's on the similar topic.
Well, it's titled That We Might Have Joy. And so it's a book. I was asked by Faith Matters, which is an organization that is promoting the kind of scholarship and art for Latter-day Saints around our Christian theology. And so I was asked if I would write a book on the integration or the relationship of sexuality and spirituality. And so since it was a book topic that I'd always thought about, cared about, but didn't yet know the answer, I said yes to it. And what I thought would be like a one-year project turned into a four-year project. But I don't regret any of it, because I've learned so much in the process of writing it and thinking about it. And so I'm excited about the book, but it's really, it's written with an LDS audience in mind, but it's really meant for anybody who's really trying to build a deeper peace in their own souls, in their marriages, in their relationship to divinity, and in their relationship to their own desires, and kind of how we grow. What's the process by which we integrate this more? How do we become more at peace with who we are? So that'll be available on Amazon, I think, like the very end of September. And And then I also do online courses, and I do, you know, retreats, as you talked about. And we have several of those coming up in the fall.
Yeah. And guys, if you're interested in that Art of Loving retreat, so that's the one for men. It was life-changing for me personally. And so whether you get the online course and go through that, or want to, you know, do a few day intensive, either way is absolutely worth it. Personally, I'm kind of a little partial to the in-person, because it's just,
yeah, they're powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the online courses are good, you know, it's really valuable to be able to go through it. And a lot of people will go to a live event and then buy the course and still go through the content over as a way of like reminding themselves of it. But the in-person's experiences are very special. They really are. It's like I'm in a conversation with a group, but people are also impacting each other. They're seeing other mm-hmm. courageous people talk honestly. You feel like, okay, I'm not so different, you know?
Right.
But you also see people there who have come a long way. You get hope from that. You're like, okay, they're like in an actually different place. I don't know. They're just my favorite. They make my favorite people show up at these events. They're earnest, honest seekers, you know, looking for something stronger and better in their lives and in their marriages. Yeah.
When I think, especially if you're struggling with pornography, it's such an isolating thing. Like, we're just so isolated. And so surrounding yourself with other men that are embarking on this journey can help you step in honestly into your full self as well. And that's what my experience was.
Yeah.
And I'll put a link again below this video to Jennifer's website so that you can check out her courses, check out the retreats that are coming up. I think that Art of Loving is in November.
That's right.
There are couples retreats that are coming up sooner if you and your partner are looking to do something. But I'll put links below. Jennifer, thank you. This is
my pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.